You are listening to the Human Rights Podcast, hosted by the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. This is a platform for dialogue and debate on issues related to human rights and international law. Hello everyone, and thank you for joining me today. I'm Anna, and on today's episode of the Human Rights Podcast, we will be focusing on gender equality by looking at gender-based violence in the international human rights law context and what role activism played in the evolution of the field. First of all, I want to welcome my guests Kelsey Brute and Mayelle Noir, two PhD candidates at the Irish Centre for Human Rights. Thank you so much for joining me today. I will give our listeners a quick introduction of the both of you before diving right into our topic. So I'll start with you, Kelsey. Kelsey Brute is a Hardiman Research PhD scholar at the Irish Centre for Human Rights. Her PhD research applies a decolonial feminist approach to examine local, alternative and restorative justice approaches in the context of post-conflict Liberia. Kelsey has experience in legal and socio-legal research, having worked as a research assistant and strategic consultant in academic and NGO spaces across a diverse range of contexts. Welcome to the podcast, Kelsey.
Thank you.
Now to you, Mayelle. Mayelle Noir is an Irish Research Council PhD scholar at the Irish Centre for Human Rights. Her PhD research addresses the question of gender-based violence against women refugees through an intersectional and decolonial feminist perspective, exploring the relevance of feminist lawyering as an alternative approach to legal practice in the Ugandan urban refugee setting. She is also a part-time research assistant in the European Union Horizon Project on Democracy and Policy. On top of that, she is a member of the National Steering Committee at NUTUT, the largest feminist collective fighting against gender-based violence in France. Welcome to you as well, Mayelle.
Thank you.
First off, I want to explain what gender-based violence actually is. Gender-based violence, of course, has two elements, gender and violence. This is why I want to start off by going a bit deeper into the question of what gender even is. I myself didn't know too much about the concept before starting my LLM here. Of course, I wanted gender equality and had a vague idea of what that might mean, but I had never envisioned gender studies to be at the core of my interests before coming to Galway. So for anybody who might be in the shoes I was in a couple of months ago, let's start at the beginning. What is gender in the first place? So traditionally, gender is a social construct, while sex is biological. In the 20th century, using gender and sex synonymously became widespread. This can be linked to the scientific discipline of sexology originating in Germany, being known there as Sexualwissenschaften. In German, there's actually no word for gender, meaning both gender and sex translate to the German word Geschlecht. I find this quite interesting, so I just wanted to give this little bit of background information on the concept of gender in the German language. Anyways, later then, gender was seen as a category related to but separate from sex. This was due to the growing realization that most, if not all, behaviors and characteristics deemed male or female are determined socially and not biologically. This binary thinking, meaning the existence of only two, right? Bi meaning two, within the categories of sex and gender emerged when the terminology became more widespread. The concept of gender has since evolved significantly and is generally a very dynamic concept. In gender medicine, for example, gender is seen as socially constructed roles and relations, personality traits, attitudes and behaviors and values that are ascribed to the two sexes in a differential manner. It has nowadays become clear that neither sex nor gender should be viewed as binary, again, meaning there only being two of each. The impossibility of trying to put humans in binary boxes, let's say, occurs not only in social sciences, but is firmly established in biomedical science as well. Gender should therefore be utilized as an umbrella term to denote diversity of human bodies and human experiences related to sex and sexuality, as Yekaterina Krivenko, a lecturer here at the Uni of Galway, suggests in her book on gender and human rights. Right, so now that we have a basic understanding of what gender is, let's go into what we mean by gender-based violence. The UN Human Rights Office considers gender-based violence to be any harmful act directed against individuals or groups of individuals on the basis of their gender. The term gender in international human rights law, and specifically in relation to gender-based violence, is strongly associated with women. These terms, however, should not be used interchangeably, nor should they be used to try and explain complexities of human behavior in a binary manner. The construction of such categories is impossible. The usefulness of categorization only stems from being able to analyze the impact the attempt of a binary construction has had on us as human beings, and how the associated expectations still affect us today. Therefore, this episode will focus on the female gender as an analytical tool, because the survivors and victims of gender-based violence continue to be disproportionately women and girls. Now that our listeners have an understanding of what we mean when referring to gender-based violence, I will turn to my guests, Kelsey and Mayel. Both of you have a research interest and have researched extensively in the area of gender-based violence. However, I've noticed while preparing for this episode that gender-based violence isn't actually mentioned in many international human rights law instruments, not even CEDAW, which is the Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which is where you would expect to find this topic, considering it has been described as a pandemic. Can you explain why that is, or how gender-based violence was actually implemented in international law?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, this may be very surprising considering that CEDAW Convention is the first gender-specific international instrument aiming at addressing all forms of discrimination against women, right? It's the International Bill of Rights for Women. And we all know that gender-based violence is one of the most rampant forms of discrimination against women, but not only, and as you just specified, as it also affects LGBTQIA+ people, and in some contexts, men. And yet, the right to be free from violence is nowhere to be found in the convention. It's interesting to highlight, though, that there was a late proposal from the Belgium delegation to include a provision regarding attacks upon the integrity of women, but unfortunately, it was rejected. This being said, as early as 1987, so only 6 years after the entry into force of the convention, as part of the sixth cycle of reporting, states actually started to report about the issue of gender-based violence. And issues reported about included domestic violence, rape, sexual violence, trafficking, sexual harassment, abuse of women prisoners, acid attacks, etc., etc. So by the end of the 90s, at least one of these issues would have been addressed by every single state party, even if this wasn't a substantial obligation of the convention per se. So one of the reasons explaining this phenomenon is civil society engagement in this reporting process through their shadow reports. So we all know that shadow reports enable to emphasize issues that the state reports might have either silenced or minimized. So they are very important to give a full and accurate picture of what's happening in the field, especially when it comes to gender discrimination, right? So of course, gender-based violence appeared as a key issue in shadow reports at a very early stage, pushing states to report on this issue too. This led to the adoption of General Recommendation Number 12 on violence against women in 1989. So this is 10 years after the adoption of the CEDAW Convention. And this general recommendation is extremely concise and does not elaborate on the gender dimension of violence against women. It just gives guidance to states on how to report on the topic, really. And this is consistent with the CEDAW committee's reticence to adopt non-binding general recommendations, especially regarding matters that are not explicitly covered in the convention, such as gender-based violence. And in fact, the first 12 general recommendations have been described as being brief and vague, and number 12 is not an exception. These critics were addressed a few years later, so in 1992, with the adoption of General Recommendation Number 19 on violence against women. This recommendation defines gender-based violence for the first time, so that's the first definition of violence against women in international law. And it also connects this issue to the purpose of non-discrimination embodied by the CEDAW Convention. However, a critique which has been formulated against this general recommendation is its lack of sensibility to the intersectional experiences of gender-based violence. So the way other power systems such as racism, classism, ableism, LGBTQIA+ phobia, refugee phobia, etc., can intersect with patriarchy to trigger violence is not discussed at all in this general recommendation. But what I want to highlight here is the peculiarity, really, of this drafting process, which was fairly unique at the time, because the CEDAW committee called NGOs to contribute. So organizations like International Women's Rights Action Watch or the International League for Human Rights even organized a dedicated seminar in New York a few days before the general recommendation was discussed. So here again, we see the importance of the power of civil society in influencing the feminist agenda towards the inclusion of gender-based violence in human rights law. Civil society continued to advocate for the right to be free from gender-based violence, especially in the 90s. So for example, in 1993, the UN World Conference on Human Rights, also known as the Vienna Convention, gathered 841 NGOs from all corners of the world. The most famous of these organizations include Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, but also other openly feminist organizations. The Vienna Declaration and Program of Action, which was enacted as the result of the conference, recognized and defined violence against women as a human rights issue. So it's the first time that we connect gender-based violence and human rights here. The General Assembly, with this declaration, urged the adoption of a declaration on the elimination of violence against women and the appointment of a special rapporteur on violence against women and girls. So a few months later, the DEVO, so Declaration on the Elimination of Violence Against Women, was adopted. And the special rapporteur was appointed in 1994. So the global NGO movements to hold states accountable for lack of action to prevent violence and to protect women and LGBTQIA+ people against such violence became even stronger during the Fourth World Conference on Women that took place in Beijing in 1995. Many NGOs started to advocate as coalition, earning a greater platform for expression in the sphere of international law and leading global campaigns to show unity in the face of violence. So that's the case of WAVE, for example, so Women Against Violence Europe. The NGO forum open to everyone, including UN and state delegates, took place 1 week before the conference. So just like for the drafting process of the General Recommendation number 12. It's often described as one of the greater successes of civil society organizing to influence a political agenda around a gender issue. Around 30,000 people attended the forum, with over 400 events happening every day, including workshops, panels, training, exhibition, etc., etc. As a result, the 1995 Beijing Declaration and Program of Action focused extensively on the urgency to tackle gender-based violence. It articulated the gendered nature of violence against women as well as patriarchy as being its root cause and consequence. So in fact, as we're discussing now, civil society represents an integral part of the development of the right to be free from gender-based violence. And still nowadays, with the importance of shadow reporting, for instance. This effort has led to the development of several regional conventions aiming at tackling gender discrimination and gender-based violence more specifically. So we can mention the Belém do Pará Convention enacted in 2004, but also the African Union Maputo Protocol adopted a year later in 2005, and closer to home, the 2011 Council of Europe Istanbul Convention. So we've come a long way, but we have gender-based violence as a right to be free from we have the right to be free from gender-based violence as a human right. More recently, in 2017, the CEDAW community issued a third general recommendation on the topic. But this time, and that's important, it's called General Recommendation number 35 on gender-based violence, as opposed to violence against women. So this is very important because the CEDAW committee no longer speaks about violence against women, but insists on its gendered nature by using this phrase. So this echoes what you were saying, Anna, about the importance of not equating gender with women. And this general recommendation, updating General Recommendation number 19, is way more detailed, way more comprehensive, with adopting a survivor-centric approach. And in the document, there is even a full paragraph dedicated to the role of NGOs. And so the committee acknowledges the fact that, and I quote, "Civil society groups, especially women's NGOs, have prioritized the elimination of gender-based violence against women, and that their activities have had a profound social and political impact, contributing to the recognition of gender-based violence against women as a human rights violation and to the adoption of laws and policies to address it."
Thank you so much, Mayel, for that great explanation and deep dive into the development of CEDAW. CEDAW, of course, was no magical fix, and during the drafting and development process of CEDAW, sexual gender-based violence was still being committed broadly, especially in conflict areas such as Rwanda and Bosnia, and of course is still happening widely to this day. Kelsey, you concentrate on transitional justice in your research. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how civil society, especially in post-conflict situations, has added to the legal framework on gender-based violence and the recognition of women as a vital part to international peace and security and international criminal law.
That's exactly it, Anna. There were a few major developments throughout the 90s that contributed towards the adoption of a human rights-based approach in addressing gender-based violence. Many of these developments are linked with the role of women as agents of peace. The Rwandan and Bosnian conflicts and their international criminal tribunals led to a global awareness of the interconnectedness of gender and conflict, and particularly drawing attention to widespread violence against women occurring during armed conflict and especially in relation to the nature of sexual violence. This ultimately culminated in the inclusion of provisions in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court on sexual violence, including its recognition as a war crime and crime against humanity. This was the first international criminal law instrument that contained provisions that explicitly address sexual violence. It enumerates several specific crimes, including rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, but it also leaves the door open for dynamic interpretation of any other form of sexual violence which is not explicitly enumerated in the Rome Statute. The Rome Statute also establishes gender as a ground of persecution, which is recognized as a crime against humanity, among other notable references to gender and gender violence throughout the statute. However, criminalization of gender-based violence is not as comprehensive, and the statute still applies a more protectionist approach. What I mean is that the only depiction of gender is in reference to the need to establish protections against violence. Though this is a major development, it renders women and gender minorities in particular as victims, and this triggers vulnerability narratives. The statute also includes a problematic definition of gender, which dichotomizes gender through a binary approach, including only references to male and female genders. So while the Rome Statute made major progress towards the recognition of both sexual and gender-based violence as crimes in international criminal law, many gaps remain, and this is particularly noticeable now in the jurisprudence of the court and the lack of general accountability for gender and sexual crimes. Also, before we go any further, it is important to highlight that sexual violence is one of the many forms of gender-based violence, but sexual violence is overemphasized in international law. Had the Rome Statute and subsequent developments in international law included more references to gender-based violence as opposed to just sexual violence, this would have led to a much wider reading for avenues of protection. But instead, we're left with this hierarchical design which places sexual violence at the top above all other forms of gender-based violence. So going back to our discussion, as a result of the Rome Statute, we have for the first time references to sexual and also gender-based violence in international criminal law, but women were resultantly categorized as victims in need of protection. There were several key developments which eventually paved the way for gender mainstreaming in international peace and security approaches. First was the Beijing Declaration, which Mael already mentioned, but one of its platforms, Platform E, focused on women and armed conflict. It connected peace with gender equality and focused on the need for gender mainstreaming, not only in armed conflict in terms of prevention and protection, but in policy development and programming generally. But at the time, there wasn't enough gender analysis integrated into the way that peacebuilding was being shaped and carried out. So another notable development is the establishment of the global campaign titled Women Building Peace, From the Village Council to the Negotiating Table, which was launched by International Alert in 1999. This resulted in the formation of a coalition of 200 civil society organizations supported by the UN Development Fund for Women, who advocated for the adoption of a UN Security Council resolution on women, peace, and security to address the lack of inclusion of gender perspectives and peace building in post-conflict reconstruction. This then led to the establishment of an NGO working group on women, peace and security, which set up an open debate to advocate for the development of a resolution on women, peace and security. Then in October 2000, the UN Security Council adopted Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security. The resolution addresses two core issues: one, equal participation of women in peacebuilding, and two, protection of women in armed conflict. Resolution 1325 was an effort to recognize women as active agents of peace and their role in peacebuilding, conflict resolution, and the need for preventive measures addressing women's structural inequality and violence against women. It also sought to mainstream gender throughout conflict prevention and peacebuilding. Though in this context, references to gender mainstreaming and gender-based violence are clearly in reference to women, while other genders are largely excluded from this framework. But compared to our earlier discussion about CEDAW and the Rome Statute, which apply a more protectionist approach, this is a notable development in proactively seeking to address gender-based violence by conceptualizing a right of women to participate in peacebuilding, conflict resolution, and conflict reconstruction. And this really links in with our discussion today because Resolution 1325 envisioned a preemptive approach that considers the nature of gender-based violence as a continuum that transcends conflict. The Women, Peace, and Security framework highlights the need for a reimagined approach to substantive equality, to remove barriers that, and to proactively implement policies to address gender inequalities, notably due to links with gender-based violence. So, some would say that Resolution 1325 envisioned a radical approach. I don't know if I would quite call it that, but ultimately its adoption was only possible due to the strong advocacy and contributions of civil society and NGOs who advocated for a radical approach. NGOs and civil society provided expert advice to UN policymakers, and perhaps most notably, they facilitated a platform where women activists could directly address policymakers and the development of the resolution. Today, civil society still plays a key role in promoting visibility and consistency in the promotion and application of the resolution in drafting shadow reports, as Mael was mentioning earlier, in connection with CEDAW, and also in filling implementation gaps. And this is particularly important. And again, this is especially important because while Resolution 1325 was a major achievement, policy development in the UN Security Council resolution at the time still failed to implement this approach in the sense that gender and women barely featured in other resolutions at the time. So this tells us that the resolution is still entrenched within a patriarchal and misogynistic structure. Other criticisms indicate that the focus on sexual violence and women, peace and security might overshadow other experiences of women and gender minorities in armed conflict, like, for example, reproductive health issues, sustainable livelihoods, and maternal mortality. And even still, sexual and gender-based violence only features twice in the resolution. So actually, they aren't even really a major priority. Since the adoption of Resolution 1325, there have been other major developments in relation to the interconnections between gender, armed conflict, and peacebuilding through UN Security Council resolutions. These can be divided into two categories. One, protections of women during armed conflict and participation in peacebuilding with emphasis on references to agency. And two, protection against sexual violence in armed conflict among women, children, and eventually men. So basically, what we're left with today is this slightly contradictory framework for addressing gender-based violence in the context of armed conflict. Because on one hand, we have a protectionist framework that reinforces vulnerability narratives and which paints a very limited picture regarding expression of gender and sexuality. And on the other hand, we have a more radical framework that articulates the right of women to participate in peacebuilding and conflict resolution as agents of peace. But gender is still narrowly interpreted, and the inclusion of diverse gender perspectives is still limited.
It's really interesting to see this history of gender-based violence in the international context and how activism has always been a big part of that. I find your perspective especially interesting because for me, my interest in gender actually came primarily from the LLM programs and from the academic side of things. But both of you have started in activism. So maybe you can tell us a bit about that and how your activism has impacted your research and how subsequently your research now has an effect on your activism.
Yeah, so I guess for me, I've been involved in activism and organizations before studying human rights. So I could say that I was an activist before being a researcher, really. I was part of Go Away Pro-Choice, which was a collective advocating for the right to access abortion during the Repeal the 8th campaign in 2017-2018. And I'd say this was my first exposure to active feminist activism. I then got involved in NUTUT, which is a collective, feminist collective tackling gender-based violence, specifically in France. We are doing a lot of sensitization and awareness raising work around the topic of gender-based violence. So I've been dedicating quite a lot of time to this cause in different capacities. So facilitating workshops, responding to the media, managing volunteers, organizing protests and other types of mobilizations since 2020. And I'd say that, you know, being involved in activism and, you know, get to work in the field also from time to time also helps me to translate the anger and frustration that researchers focusing on gender-based violence can feel into concrete action. So, you know, like how to sort of overcome this frustration of, yes, I'm reading, researching, writing about gender-based violence, but, you know, what can be done very concretely on the short term, right? So I'd say this has, you know, this has helped me a lot to also remain focused on my research on gender-based violence, because it is informed by the fields as well. So I don't know, Casey, if you want to complement that with your own experience.
Yeah, just kind of building on that point a little bit. I mean, I've always considered myself an activist, but really my activism has been influenced by my research. And that's especially because as human rights researchers, as you're saying, Mairead, we often, you know, develop these frustrations where, you know, we're reading about gender inequality and about contributions among civil society and NGOs, but it can be a frustrating process whereby, you know, where we might envision a more radical approach. And then at the end of the day, what we have is a policy development that actually is not quite reflective of what we might have imagined. But I think that it's really important to be able to translate this frustration that we have as researchers into activism. And this itself, I think, is a form of power. But then for me, you know, I'm a Canadian national studying or doing my research here in Ireland. And so I also find it a bit hard to find a space where I feel like I can engage in activism, where I feel like I belong in an activist space. And you know, it's really important to consider that there are diverse approaches and perspectives to activism. And for example, you know, how we engage in activism in Ireland here is very different from how activists engage in other countries. And the reason why is because we're really challenging fundamentally different systems of power. Yes, they're all interconnected, but the way that we experience gender-based violence here in Ireland is going to be different than the way that people experience gender-based violence in other contexts. And so it's really important to remember that there are diverse experiences with activism and diverse ways of representing and engaging in activism. And I think this kind of links to the idea that, you know, being an activist, or at least being an ally, it's about not taking up too much space and noticing where your space is and where you belong and when it's appropriate for you to be engaging in activism. Mairead, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I totally agree. And I'd say also that would be a way that my activism is now informing my work as well. This idea of finding your space and to know when to leave the space to the experts, basically. And so, like, you know, being part of NUTUT, which is often described as a mainstream organization and mostly composed of white, cis, able-bodied women, you know, we tend to use the prism of our own experience to inform our activism. And this can be exclusionary, like it can exclude a lot of people. And it's the same in our research, you know, like who are we including, who are we excluding, you know, from where are we organizing? From where are we researching? You know, where is the margin? Where is the center? And at NUTUT, I'm doing a lot of work on coalition building and allyship politics, as you mentioned, Kelsey. So I guess, like, I came to better understand issues such as gender-based violence and transphobia, gender-based violence and racism, and gender-based violence and ableism, for example, but also to engage with other topics such as sex work and sex worker rights. And I guess sometimes also it's also a matter of posture, where we stand and who do we listen to. As researchers, we're often seen as experts and in a position of having knowledge. But really, and that's also the case because Kelsey and I are both doing field research and we're looking at empirical methodologies as well. It's very important also to remember how these impact the research process, like these power dynamics and our relationship with participants to research, etc., etc. So I guess this is also how perhaps my activism is also informing methodologies of research.
And trying to creatively, you know, engage in research and trying to creatively provide for opportunities to create outlets to be able to discuss that research. I think it's really still a developing area. And, you know, it's very, it can be a bit tricky then also because of connections with our research, Esma, that you're saying that we're doing research in, like my research focuses on the Liberian context, Mad, your research focuses on the Ugandan context. And so when we're thinking as research as activism and through these kind of like alternative platforms for dissemination, it's also a bit tricky going back to the whole idea of, you know, where do we belong as activists and what is our space? Because certainly my space as a researcher, as an activist, is certainly not within the context of where my research focuses. And there's a lot of power dynamics involved in that as well.
It makes me think about what Anna says about her own exposure to these concepts of gender and how perhaps before starting this LLM, you were not like particularly sensitized or interested in this notion. So it also shows that it's our responsibility as researchers and if we also teach, you know, to provide students with an exposure to these concepts that, you know, are complex in nature. I mean, we've been articulating concepts here such as, you know, gender-based violence, intersectionality. These are very difficult and complex concepts, but it's also interesting, I think, to see how these concepts travel between the activist space and the academic space. Intersectionality, for example, is a term that actually originates from Black liberation movement, and that was then translated into a conceptual framework by Kimberlé Crenshaw in the 90s. But, you know, like, it's very important to acknowledge the activist roots of this movement, of this concept. And now it's, you know, going back to the activist space and how it's also mobilized and articulated and often appropriated as well by mostly white feminist movements in that case. And gender, for example, would be a counter example of this, of a concept that developed, as Anna mentioned, in biomedical sciences and then social sciences, feminist studies, gender studies, etc., etc., and traveled back to the activist space, where it's now constantly being mobilized and articulated to claim rights and to, you know, ensure a certain process of mainstreaming of this term in human rights law, as we've been discussing. But just like perhaps coming back to academia as a place of power and also a platform to provide students with exposure. Like, I'm interested to hear about Anna and Anna's experiences about this, you know, about being exposed to different concepts.
For me, it was really my first exposure to these broader concepts of analyzing gender, or, you know, all topics really from different perspectives. Like you were saying, intersectionality is so very important, but in, well, most international laws still have these silos, right, of this is about gender and then this is about race. But really, without looking at everything together, you can't really form a real opinion, you know. You can't really get the whole picture, which is really what we should want if we want systematic change, which is of course what we need, right?
And this is observable in the CEDAW convention, and I'm sure Casey, you could talk about peace and conflict agenda, but like this whole idea of operating in silos. And first of all, just the idea of having the CEDAW convention as a gender specific instrument, and how then the question of gender discrimination is to be dealt with separately and, you know, in a separate manner from other categories of human rights, you know. So this also speaks volume about the approach that is being taken as part of this process of mainstreaming gender in human rights and human rights protection. So I don't know, Casey.
I actually want to go back to an idea that she brought up earlier, Maz, and I think it also really speaks to your experience, Anna, as a student, you know, that sometimes the first exposure that you have to a particular rights issue is through education, it's through university institutions, or maybe in other contexts as well, maybe through a national curriculum. But I think that it really gets at kind of the nature of these frameworks as being, as we were talking about before, patriarchal, hierarchical, and very elitist. And, you know, it's all because how is it that you expect to somebody that you expect somebody to be able to articulate their rights if they're not informed because of the lack of accessibility of knowledge? And so I think that that's one of the persisting challenges that we have, because all of these concepts that we're discussing today, you know, concepts of gender-based violence, intersectionality, they have these, you know, flows in between and out of academia and activism, as Mel, that you were talking about before, as with the example of the concept of intersectionality. But at the same time, the concepts that we are developing in academic spaces sometimes aren't always translated, and this goes as well for the concepts we're developing as experts in international law. When we develop a framework for to articulate rights, you know, rights are articulated in a very narrow and in a very particular way, but then we expect ordinary people to be able to access that information and to be able to use it to be able to claim their rights and defend their rights. And I think this just speaks overall to one of the major challenges that we face. Certainly, this is a major challenge as well in the area of women, peace and security as well, in looking at post-conflict reconstruction and being able to identify crimes that occurred during armed conflict and then to be able to claim even reparations. You know, it involves access to the language to be able to actually articulate a rights claim. And I think that this is a big challenge that we have right now that we need to address.
Absolutely. And I think when you look at, for example, CEDAW, right, they do have an individual complaint mechanism, but it's completely underutilized. I think partly because nobody even knows it exists, but then also even if you do know that it exists, how do you access it, right? How would an ordinary person, like you were saying, just go to CEDAW and complain? I mean, that's not realistic, but it should be, you know.
And even if you look at the content of the law, you know, and I mean, thank God it's being informed by NGOs and civil society movement, because the disconnect, you know, between the lawmaking space and society is huge.
Exactly.
And this is why today's episode is really important, I think, you know, to first of all, acknowledge, recognize the role of civil society movements in the development of the right to be free from violence, which is a right that, you know, we should take for granted. But again, as, you know, we go back to the discussion, 1979, it is not included in the CEDAW Convention. So I think it's very important to always acknowledge the role of activism in the development of human rights standards, and gender-based violence is an example, but I'm sure we could find so many others to discuss.
And I think it's really just a call to us as researchers to continue to push ourselves to reimagine the ways that we're disseminating our research, to continue to challenge these normative frameworks in the way that we actually like engage with them, you know, and certainly the interconnection between civil society and the articulation of frameworks in international law is something that we just need to continue to reimagine a new way of engaging in these kinds of interactions.
And with that, Kelsey, I think that was a great way to end this episode, right? To remember that we need to look at ourselves and our own research and how we engage with civil society and the law and how we bridge that gap. So thank you so much to Kelsey and Mayel for joining me during this valuable dialogue of how activism and research influence the field of gender-based violence. I hope us discussing the relationship of gender and violence today was beneficial to you and has perhaps even broadened your understanding on the concept of gender. You have been listening to the Human Rights Podcast. The podcast is produced by staff and students at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway, and supported by the University's Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. This episode was produced by Anna Gordon.